Thanks, Jim. Good morning, everyone. Hi, my name is Hank, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's wonderful to be here with you. It's wonderful to see familiar faces and friends I haven't met yet. And that's one of the beauties for me of AA is this, just what you're reading from that forward to the second edition was talking about the amazing connection that exists between us all, whether we know each other or not. Jim was mentioning that well, this is a Zoom meeting, and he was talking about my involvement in service. And one of the things I've had a chance to do is to be involved through Zoom in a lot of international AA activity. And I remember several years ago, I was helping the general service structure in Mongolia to deal with the general service office in New York over issues of publishing AA literature in Mongolian. And I got a chance at around that time. AA, the people, the fellowship in Mongolia was celebrating 25 years of AA in Mongolia. And I remember attending virtually a meeting with probably about 12 Mongolian women dressed in traditional Mongolian garb. And they were speaking in Mongolian, and there was a celebration going on, and they were singing, they were singing in joy and celebration. And I, of course, I don't understand a word of Mongolian. I don't even know if that's what they call the language in Mongolia, but what I felt was a deep connection with these people whom I had never met and whose culture I really don't understand. But that connection, one alcoholic talking with another, and the power of unity that exists in our fellowship, his essay on Tradition One in the 12 and 12, Bill says that the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous is the most precious quality our fellowship possesses. And I always marvel over that sentence because AA possesses so many precious qualities. I know it saved my life and saved the lives, I'm sure, of many others on this meeting. And so what does Bill select as our most precious quality? He identifies the unity of AA. And he says that if it weren't for the unity of AA, if we didn't put our common welfare first, then AA would die, and so would we. And that's those are strong words that Bill used. I don't know. Would we all die? I know that when I celebrated 5 years of sobriety, two old timers came up to me. I came into AA in my 60s, in my mid 60s. I just recently turned 79. I got sober in 2011, so I'm in my 15th year. But when I celebrated 5 years, two old timers came up to me. People, that I'd known since I came in, and the first guy that came up to me, 35 years of sobriety, and he said, "Hank, when you first got here, I thought you were the biggest asshole I'd ever met." And I remember thinking to myself, "Well, like this guy's 35 years in AA, he's met a lot of alcoholics, probably a lot of assholes, and I'm number one on his asshole list." So, maybe that's something. But the second guy that came up to me said, "Hank, when you first got here, We weren't so worried about your going back to drinking. We thought you'd probably kill yourself. And I told my sponsor that, and he said that he never thought I was suicidal, but he thought I might just die. He said, because the flame of life was very dim inside of me. That was those were his words. So, Bill says that if AA doesn't survive, maybe we don't either. And, maybe that's true for me. So, when I get the opportunity to give a talk to an AA group, which is, of course, a real blessing to be able to share ourselves with each other, I usually start off by asking everyone for a moment of silent prayer, that I be able to set aside my old ideas and my own ego and be a channel for the message that our Creator wishes for me to deliver. And so maybe I'll just ask for a moment now. Thank you. I always, my blood pressure always goes down. I do that, I figure, okay, well, whatever happens from here on out, I'm not in charge, So that's great. I was thinking about whether I would do that because Jim asked me to read that set aside prayer, and I thought, well, maybe that serves the same function. But whatever I think, the hell with it. And so I wanted to start today with a reading from the big book. It's on page 55 in the big book in the chapter We Agnostics. And it's sort of, this is kind of like for me the North Star of the way I see our practice, certainly for me personally. So it says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or another, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. This is a great sentence coming up. We found the great reality, capital G, capital R, deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. We can only clear the ground a bit if our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself. Then, if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. So, I when the typical idea of a lead is to use that phrase from How It Works, what it was like, what happened, and what it was like now, or what it's like now. And certainly, he starts out that this passage that I just read, he talks about that this fundamental idea of God is deep down within us, but he says that it may be obscured by pomp, by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. And I know, as from the vantage point of the relatively, well, I'm not going to judge whether, I'm not going to judge the length of time I've been in AA. It just is what it is, right? But I've I've had a great deal of healing since I've come into this fellowship, and that passage kind of lays out the roadmap of it. And when I came in, this power that I now understand to be inside of me, this great reality, I love that phrase, the truth, you know, the great reality. The Buddhists talk a little bit about two different kinds of reality. They talk about historical reality and ultimate reality. And, you know, I sort of think the great reality sounds like ultimate reality, you know, like whatever may be going on in our lives at any given time is kind of like waves on the surface of the ocean. But deep down, the ocean has a rhythm of its own, that the waves are just ripples on the surface. And what I find is that the place that I've been led by AA, that place deep down inside of us, has a rhythm of its own. And when I get caught up in the chaos of the waves on the surface, it's just the distraction from the deeper rhythm that the ocean has of its own. And but when I came in, I thought the waves were life, you know. I thought the chaos of my life was what life was. You know, I like I say, I came into AA in my 60s, and I'm a lawyer by training, and I'd practiced law in downtown Buffalo for several decades, and you know, I'd had some professional success, but my world had collapsed, and my now ex-wife had invited me not to return home, and my law practice had collapsed, and my marriage had collapsed, and I was no longer living at home. I'd gone from living on a 250-acre horse farm with 50 thoroughbred horses to couch surfing with friends, and you know, my life was a total disaster. And I after a few years after I was invited not to return home in 2008, and after a couple of years, I found myself living in a little cottage out in Angola, New York, which is a suburb to the south of Buffalo, for those who are from out of town. And you know, it was a big come down, you know. But you know, thank goodness there was vodka in the freezer and beer in the fridge, and thank God they were there. When I used to drink in the bars in Buffalo when I was a self-described hotshot lawyer, you know, we'd say things like "life sucks and then you die," and that's what passed for truth in that world. And the guy that dies with the most toys wins, you know, that kind of stuff. And you know, by the time I got to AA, the toys were gone, you know, the and life sucked. And I was pretty hopeless, and you know, the guy who became my sponsor, as I said later, said that he thought I might just die. So I first got involved in the 12-step fellowship in Al-Anon. I'd had a counselor suggest that I go to Al-Anon because I come from a drinking family. And I just a little side note on that. I'm coming from a drinking family. There's a in Buffalo, there's, as you may know, there's an AA meeting of the lawyers in AA, you know, the Erie County Bar Association. There's a committee, you know, called Lawyers Helping Lawyers. And I the first time I came to that meeting, I walked in, and here's my cousin sitting at the meeting, right? And she was a family court judge, and she'd been in the fellowship for 44 years, and she told me a lot about the alcoholism in my family. Anyway, you know, that reading, that passage talked about how that our connection with this power deep down inside of us, deep down in that ocean, is obscured by calamity and pomp and worship of other things. And certainly, calamity was the name of the game for me. And pomp was too. You know, there's a great phrase in the Big Book. It talks about an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And that's what I was for sure. You know, I was arrogant. I was terrified. I was the only thing I knew was my own thinking, and of course, my thinking was a disaster. I didn't think that. Hell, I'd been a really successful lawyer. You know, how could you know? And you know, alcoholism is a lonely disease, and you know, we can be involved in superficial relationships with other people, but it's mostly self-seeking, you know. And it's on my part, it was neediness. I know when I did a fifth step, my sponsor told me that I'd been abused as a child, and I didn't really have a name for that. It's just kind of what my life was. But I you know, knew from early childhood that somehow I was different, and that, you know, I was isolated. I built up these walls, and the only power that I felt in life, the only outlet really was resentment. And you know, my dad was physically abusive, and I can remember vividly the last time he hit me. I was in my early teens, and he took a belt and slashed me across the chest with a belt, and I looked at him, and I just looked at him, and deep down inside, you know, that resentment and hatred and fear was so powerful that it came through my whole being. And he never hit me again after that occasion. And I think that the power of my resentment got through to him, and he knew that, well, I don't know what he knew, but it was the last time he ever hit me. So one of the character defects was that I found strength in resentment. And but you know, it tells us in the book, it tells us that alcohol is just a symptom of our disease, and that when it talks about step four, that we have to get down to causes and conditions. And the book tells us that resentment is the number one offender. And you know, resentment was my power. One of the things that you know, I understand, I don't know whether these statistics are accurate, but I've heard that the incidence of alcoholism among lawyers is something like 2 to 5 times the incidence of the general population. And I don't know what that means, but I know from my own experience that, you know, aggression, hostility, resentment, that power can contribute to great success as a lawyer. You know, you get in a courtroom and fuck you, you know, your face is coming off and mine's staying on, you know, and people will pay you a lot of money for that kind of resentment. And, you know, but I don't want to ignore the thing that unites us all, the booze, right? You know, I mean, I grew up in a drinking family. You know, drinking's what we did, you know. And, you know, I often hear people in AA talk about their first drink, that they remember their first drink. I don't remember my first drink. There's a picture of me in a high chair as a little toddler with a bottle of Jenny Cream Ale on the on the platform of the high chair. You know, I don't know whether I was drinking it or not, but what I do remember is the first time I threw up, you know. And one of the things that helps me identify with members of Alcoholics Anonymous is if you remember the coolness of porcelain on the side of your cheek, you know, as your head is in the toilet bowl, you know, you're probably an alcoholic. And that's a coolness that I can feel on my cheek right now. Been a long time since I threw up in the toilet from drinking, but I still remember that coolness. But I spent a couple of years in Al-Anon, and for me, it was mostly a pity party. I was full of self-pity, and I met a Native American guy in Al-Anon. And when I moved out to Angola, I was seeing a counselor at the time, and the counselor said, "Why are you moving to Angola? It's the drug capital of Western New York." And, you know, I don't know. I found a nice place, and I'll just give you a picture, because I'm still in that same cottage, and it's beautiful here, actually. And I just live right on Lake Erie, and you know, right on the edge of Avangola State Park. But I didn't see any of that beauty when I moved into this cottage. What gave me solace was the vodka in the freezer and the beer in the fridge, you know, and otherwise, you know, my life was a disaster. And, you know, I was so involved in the pomp and calamity and worship of other things. And I really worshiped my pain. It was all I knew, you know, so, you know, I held on to it. There was a sense of identity that all the turmoil of my life. I almost died of a bleeding ulcer when I was a senior in high school. When I got to college, I was so full of terror. I had no idea how to function in an adult world. I ended up dropping out of law school after my first year of law school because I had no idea how to function. And I bought a one-way plane ticket to Paris, and I took a guitar and a backpack. And, you know, I had this Jack Kerouac version of what was going to happen. And that was one of my first spiritual awakenings. I landed in Orly Airport in Paris, and I had this sort of "oh my God" moment, which was I realized, oh my God, it's just as bad in Paris as it was in New York, you know, because I was there, you know, wherever we go, there we are. So, and that ended up with a very deep dive into alcoholism and drug abuse. And I ended up living in Amsterdam, on a houseboat in the canals in Amsterdam, which was the drug capital of the world and the headquarters of Heineken beer. So it was a great place to really tear my life down even further. But I, you know, there's a lot of drunkalogue stories. one story from my time in Amsterdam. I became an entrepreneur in Amsterdam. As I say, it's the drug capital of the world, so I got involved in the drug trade, I remember that the sort of the word on the street at this particular time was that some guys had come into Amsterdam with 50 kilos of Moroccan hashish and that they were trying to sell, and everybody was running around trying to figure out how to make a deal like that. That's about 110 pounds, you know. I remember in Holland, the serious criminals in the drug world, that segment of the world was dominated by people from an island called Suriname, which was a Dutch colony, and they were black. And these one day on this houseboat I was living on, these five black guys came onto my onto my little houseboat, and I didn't know them, and but they knew me. They knew Hank, and they said that they had a proposition for me. They said, "You know, we can't get into that hotel room. Nobody's going to let a black man into that hotel room, but you can get in. You're white," they said. "And so you get in, you let us in, we'll kill everybody, and we'll take the drugs and the money, and we'll split it six ways." And I knew, you know, like in even though my brain was pretty addled, I knew that once I got them in there, they didn't need me anymore, you know. And there's no honor among thieves, so I knew there wouldn't be a six-way split. But I just knew what I really knew at that point was that I was in over my head. And it was shortly after that that the Dutch police arrested me and deported me to New York, and so I got a free trip home. Anyway, I, you know, I. What I want to talk about, I want to go back to that passage from page 55 of the book, and I think you can see the purpose, I think, of what I've been saying so far is to talk about how my connection with this power inside was obscured by pomp and calamity and worship of other things. I mean, it was one shit show after another in my life. Despite all these this economic success, I did made a lot of money as a lawyer, but it was all gone by the time I got to AA. And when I moved out to Angola, this Native American guy who I knew from Al-Anon, turned out he lived on the Seneca Indian Reservation, which is right near near Angola, and he took me to my first AA meeting. And you know, it was in this stinky trailer that you know smelled of sulfur water, and you know I still clung to my identity as a big shot, you know, all the money I had made. And here I am in this trailer with guys with chains to their wallets, you know, and, you know, like, I wait a minute, I have a Mercedes, you know, I'm a big shot. What am I doing here? And I remember one of the guys told me, he said, "Hank, you know, with a guy like you, what we do with you is we pick you up by your ankles and shake you till all the money falls out of your pockets." And of course, by that time, most of it had already fallen out anyway. But I did not think I was an alcoholic. You know, I think if you had my life, you'd drink too. So my problem wasn't alcohol. It was my ex-wife, it was my kids, you know. And I fought it. I'd go to these meetings and I'd argue and struggle, put up a terrible fight. And I think that's why that guy said to me that he thought I was the biggest asshole he'd ever met. But I kept coming. I came to AA meetings every day. And I didn't know why I was doing it. And I continued to drink. Jim's heard me tell the story of the last drink that I've taken up till today, which was on April 25th, 2011. And I had 14-year-old twin sons. They were 14 at the time. And they didn't, I had dinner with them at Red Lobster in the McKinley Mall. Again, Jim's heard me tell this story, and others here probably have as well. But I walked into that restaurant and I looked at those boys, whom I loved to the bottom of my heart. And I knew they wanted nothing to do with me. And I thought I had a solution for the loneliness and futility that was in my heart. Those four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. That's how I felt. And I, you know, they have a bar in Red Lobster. I tried to kill that feeling. And the next day, I was in the office of the guy who's now my sponsor. And, I told him about how terrible the night before had been, and he asked me, did I think maybe drinking with my kids maybe showed that I was powerless over alcohol, and that was a shocker. But what it was that great reality. I had a vision of the truth about what a disaster my life was that night, and when I saw those boys. And that vision of the truth, I know Bill talks about, that what made it possible for him to stop drinking was when he heard Dr. Silkworth say that his case was hopeless and he was going to die. And that was a vision of truth for him, and allowed a spiritual awakening to come in. I think being with my boys was a vision of the truth that, I'd lost the thing that was most precious to me in my life, my children. And and so I haven't had a drink since then. My sponsor Chuck, who I know is a member of this group, or I believe he is, he read me the Bedevilments, page 55 of the big book, and 52, excuse me. And just the breeze has blown open my book to page 52, so I'll read those to you. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. And that was me. That was me. I could argue about whether I drank as much as you or did as many drugs or, whatever. But that was me. And I knew it. And, that was the breakthrough that allowed me to face that great reality. So, I'm checking the time here, and I'm realizing that I spent an awful lot of time on my drunk log, and I apologize for that, because of course that if I go back there to page 55, it talks about that, our connection with this power that's deep down inside of us is obscured by pomp and calamity and worship of other things. And I've been trying to describe how it was obscured for me, my connection with this power. And in the time remaining, I'd like to focus on what's happened to clear away that wreckage of the past for me. And of course, it's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first thing that happened was that Well, you know that I had that spiritual awakening on that day, you know, when Chuck read me those bedevilments, and you know, that led us into a process that had me kneeling on the floor of his office, holding hands, you know, like this, and saying the third step prayer. It wasn't that day, but it followed thereafter. You know, I didn't know anything else, but finally, there was some kind of path. I thought life was hopeless, but now, you know, something was opening up for me. You know, I understand that Bill was asked at one time what he thought the most important step was. I don't know if this is a true story or not, but the story as I've heard it is that Bill said step four, of course, is the most important step. And, you know, my experience of step four, both for myself and for people that I've sponsored since then, is that's where our focus begins to change. That, you know, we begin step four with that resentment that I was talking about before, and how the world is not fair, and how life is not fair, and it's not right. And as we go through the fourth step process, we turn around and realize we're creating our own misery. We're creating our own misery. And I think in the case of child abuse, you know, of course, you know, it's hard to say that a little child is responsible for what happens to the child. But what does happen, and I can testify from personal experience, is that my personality is formed with the vision that life is unfair, that life is dangerous, that no one can be trusted. And that's what I knew was true. So it kept me isolated from the world. And of course, alcohol was one of the few things that could medicate that isolation. But what I realized, and I see today, is that those lessons that I learned as a child have been crippling me for my entire life, and that there is blessing in life. I am not in danger today, except for the consequences of my own actions. That there is a possibility of having those old ideas healed. And so I work through step four, and I begin to see this, and I share it with a sponsor who helps me see what's really going on. And then, you know, I see that the solution that AA offers me is in steps six and seven. It come next, right after I've done that fourth and fifth step. And what I see is that I can't do anything about these character defects. I can't change them because that word I that I'm using is really my old ideas. I identify it with my old ideas. But what AA shows me is no, there's something deeper. Those are just the waves on the surface of the ocean, that there is a deep rhythm to life deep down inside that will bring that healing. If I can let go of my iron grip on my old ideas. And so what AA tells me is, okay, become willing to loosen your grip. That's step six. Become willing to have these defects removed. And then to humbly ask for their removal. And what I've come to understand is that there really is this power deep down inside of every man, woman, and child, and not just inside of every man, woman, and child, but every blade of grass, every cloud in the sky, the great reality. It's there, and it's there. And if I'm not fighting it with my old ideas, I'm okay. I will be healed. I will be guided. So what happened next for me was to go into an amends process. And I'm looking at the time that remains to me here. And I don't want to go too deeply into the amends process, but I will tell you this. When I came into AA, I had not spoken to my dad was dead, and I hadn't spoken to my mother or to my siblings in like 13 years. And Chuck guided me through a living amend with my mom, and it was a very frightening process, but I did it. And the healing was unbelievable. After 13 years of non-existent, she had a few years left to live. She was quite old at the time, very vibrant. She had spent some time in AA, but it never stuck for her. I was with her when she died, I have some cards in my bedside nightstand that she had sent me with things like, where would I be without you? So we got to be very close, and I understood that we were very much alike. And I guess, as my time comes to an end here, I'd say this whole process for me has ended up, in a sense, with steps 10, 11, and 12, but it's really flowered on that because, as AA grew over the years, and matured over the years, we became not just a 12-step program, but a three legacies program. And the three legacies, recovery, unity, and service, the circle and triangle, are rooted in step 12, really, carrying the message. We have a structure to carry that message, and we be of service carrying the message. But just going back and touching on steps 6 and 7, I spent probably 3 years. I have an active meditation practice, and I spent 2 or 3 years meditating on Bill's essays on steps 6 and 7. And slowly, what evolved for me is that became my practice of steps 10 and 11. And Bill says in his essay in the 12 and 12 on step 11, he says that when you put steps 10 and 11 together, self-examination, prayer, and meditation, they form an unshakable foundation for life. And that's a hell of a promise, an unshakable foundation for life. And I've actually found that to be the case. And whenever I can revert to that practice of allowing myself to be carried by that rhythm of the deep ocean of reality, rather than try to run around with the waves up on the surface, it is an unshakable foundation for life. What I try to do now is I try to stay grounded in my practice of 10 and 11. And then I try to help carry the AA message by being involved in service. And I think that one of the things that AA has lost a little bit with the rise of treatment centers and all of that kind of thing, we don't do as much 12-step work as used to be done. And we're really missing out, I think. And I think that service, through treatment and all the different ways that we can carry the AA message is a blessing for all of us. I know it is for me. So I'm grateful for our three legacies. I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful for the Men Who Trudge group for the opportunity to be here with you. God bless you, and God bless AA. Thank you.